Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. On this podcast, I also sometimes focus on the topic of political polarization, because I think that's the biggest danger humanity faces, and because it is directly related to our difficulties in understanding each other. You can learn more about this podcast at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. If you like the work I do and want to encourage me to spend more time on these things, you can sign up for a premium subscription to this podcast, which gets you a few benefits. If you're interested in reducing us versus them polarization, you might also like to check out my book, Diffusing American Anger, which is at american-anger.com. On this episode, I talked to Vanessa Otero, who is the founder of Adfontis Media. Vanessa is most well known for creating a chart ranking the bias of various news outlets. This chart has gotten a lot of attention. There's a good chance you've seen it if you've spent much time looking at political content online. In 2016, when she created her chart and the methodology behind it, she was working as a patent attorney. Due to the respect she got for that work on her media bias chart, she was able to turn that into a full-time career. She founded Adfontis Media in 2018. As you'll hear us talk about later in this talk, one of the reasons she started working on analyzing media bias was to combat polarization and our hugely divergent narratives. She sees reducing bias in media and encouraging people to read less biased news sources as one of the ways we can combat toxic polarization. You can learn more about Vanessa and her work at adfontesmedia.com. That's A-D-F-O-N-T-E-S. A big part of our talk is focused on the question, how can we try to reduce bias when all of us are biased? If all of us are biased, as we all clearly are, how can we try to analyze and mitigate bias? Other topics discussed include, what's the process look like for Adfontis' analysis of bias? How do they categorize something as left or right, especially considering how turbulent and quickly changing some of the group stances can be? How media bias relates to polarization, the word misinformation and why the use of it can be seen as liberal-leaning, the pushback of liberal-leaning news outlets to Trump and how that can result in more bias and more perceptions of bias, AI approaches to algorithmically detecting bias. If you'd like to hear more background about how Vanessa got into this work, I'd recommend listening to an interview with her on David French's podcast, Advisory Opinions. That was a talk in early September 2023. I'll include a link to that and to other resources mentioned in this talk on the entry for this episode on my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. Okay, here's the talk with Vanessa Otero. Hi, Vanessa. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Zach.
Oh, my pleasure. So I realized this would be a big question, and you also go into detail about this on your site. Is it possible to give an overview of your approach for determining a news outlet's bias? What does the general start to finish process look like?
Great question. It's always top of folks' minds. How do we actually come up with news ratings for reliability and bias? So we have a content analysis approach. It's really all about looking at the content, the rhetoric that's in there on the page or in the episode when it's audio or video. And we have a big team of analysts. We have almost 60 analysts right now on staff at Adfontis Media who are politically balanced left, right, and center. It's a really important part of mitigating our own biases. And they go through pretty extensive training on this methodology we've developed where we look at subfactors that determine overall reliability, subfactors that determine overall bias. And to come up with an overall news source rating for a big national publication, we will rate a representative sample of those articles. And to date, we usually have several hundred articles from big publications. And each one of them will be looked at by a panel of our analysts, one left, one right, one center. And they'll score it on a rubric. We have this grading rubric that goes from top to bottom and from left to right. It's a point scale. And they're looking for various things throughout that. And because they're looking at a very granular piece of content, they can usually come to a pretty close consensus or within a score range right off the bat. You know, they can look at a left-leaning opinion article and say, this is a left-leaning opinion article. even if one person's left and one person's right. So we've done that over the years, over the last 4 years, with over 70,000 individual pieces of content. And that's how we come up with our overall ratings.
And what was it that you'd say you brought to the table that was different? Because there have been other attempts to rate bias, right? Like, I was just looking at All Sides and their attempts to rate bias. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the value you want to bring to that space.
Yeah. You know, the complaints that folks commonly bring when you're trying to measure something that seems just so subjective is as much objectivity as possible, right? I mean, these are things written by humans and assessed by humans. So to me, we have a unique taxonomy, right? Rating something from top to bottom on a media bias chart, you have to make decisions on what makes something good, like what puts something at the very top, what puts something like a little under that, what puts something in the middle, what makes something okay, and what makes it problematic or misleading or inaccurate, what makes something, you know, not just centrist or like a little left or a little right, but what makes it like really far left or right biased. And having really specific definitions for each one of those, that's one unique thing we brought to the table. And scoring it on a very granular article by article basis. I mean, the primary complaint I would get when I first put out, you know, the media bias chart when it was just me was like, hey, you're biased. And I was like, well, how do I mitigate that? How do I know we can't eliminate it. So mitigating had to be the most important question. And it seemed reasonable to recruit people with different political perspectives and include them as a part of the process. But to be as objective as possible, you know, that's a different question. It's all about, it's not just about the taxonomy, it's about the methodology for like, how do you select what's a representative sample of content? How do you do it fairly across tens of thousands of information sources? Our approach is the only one where we're trying to replicate it as consistently as possible across all the different formats.
Did I understand correctly that part of what you were doing differently was the different axes? Like, you rated the, you rate the accuracy separately from the bias, because theoretically you can have an outlet be very accurate, but be biased in what they focused on. Am I understanding that correctly?
Right. I mean, left-right perspectives, left-right ideology, left-right moral foundations, there's nothing inherently wrong with those. There's nothing inherently wrong with advocating or focusing on things that are of more interest to folks that are more left-leaning or right-leaning. And things can be highly accurate, highly reliable, and still be left or right. When you get really, really biased, like, there are typically other factors that will bring down reliability. So if you look at the shape of how things are plotted on our chart, there's a high but an imperfect correlation between things that are in the middle and things that are, you know, really far left and right, and how reliable those are. But you, like, one way that you can tell they're somewhat independent variables is if you look at them just straight down the middle of the chart, you'll see stuff that's way at the top, but then there's some stuff that's kind of in the middle or at the bottom. So just being middle, does, we're not saying middle is good. And if you look at the, especially like the skews left and the skews right categories, those columns, you can see stuff that's way closer to the top and stuff that's way closer to the bottom. Those can vary, even if they have the same actual bias score.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me there, it's very much related to polarization and conflict, because, you know, we often focus on, I think the focus on wrong information or distorted information gets a lot of attention, but people have also written and researched how polarization, us versus them feelings, make us basically filter for true things, like real things, but it's just in the way we filter for them. So you can imagine like a far right outlet that's just writing only about true things, but they're all things that are, you know, supporting the conservative point of view. It's just a matter of like filtering for those things and leaving out the other things, right?
Exactly.
I'm understanding that you would factor in that kind of like filtering for only one, that unilateral filter would be a reason to call something biased, if I'm understanding correctly.
Definitely. We liken it to how lawyers argue in court. So lawyers can be very opinionated and very persuasive, and content that we read in our political landscape can be very opinionated. But lawyers can use just the facts that are helpful to their side, right? They're not required to also include all the other facts that aren't helpful. Mm-hmm. But there's a line, right? Like, a lawyer will get in trouble if they're leaving out things that are so critical to the story that it totally changes the meaning of things, right? So folks have a hard time with what that line is. And sometimes folks have a hard time reading a highly reliable piece that it is factual reporting. And yes, it's just focusing on the stuff that's more favorable to one side or the other, but they have a hard time seeing it.
Getting back to what you said about bias is always present. How do I mitigate bias? I really like the part on your website where you had an FAQ section with the question, aren't you biased? Isn't Ad Fontes biased? And maybe you could talk a little bit about what you wrote for that and what informed, you know, why you saw that as important to point out.
Yeah. And the short answer to the FAQ, are you biased, is yes. So, you know, we're all biased. We all have our life experiences, and the sample of content that we've read in our lifetimes is all different. Like, all the things that you've read are very different from all the things that I've read. And they're even more different from folks who you disagree with politically, right? So we don't think that being, you know, centrist or being of any particular political lean yourself is the most important requirement to do this work. Because we have, in society, there are certain positions that we ask people to set aside their preconceived notions and just be as fair as possible. That's, you know, judges and referees, they have their political views, they have their personal views and feelings. We're asking them to be fair. We're not asking them to be neutral, though. And I like to make this distinction because, you know, if you're a judge, if we were asking a judge to be neutral, you know, there's two sides in a part in every case. If we asked them to be neutral at the end of the case, I'd be like, okay, well, you know, you both have a point. We're asking them to be fair. We're asking them to make a call, like, in view of all the facts presented, make a call. So that's what we're endeavoring to do here. And mitigation of bias, like just trying to have as little bias as possible, is so critical in not just the work that we do, but the work the journalists do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we give people credit. We give journalists credit for trying, because there are outlets out there that don't try.
Right.
Just, I mean, they specifically said, like, this is from a socialist perspective, or we are fighting the leftist narrative, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So distinguishing between those things is important, I think.
Yeah, you get bonus points for trying.
Yes. and we definitely try. So, and we can't,
I don't mean you, I mean the journalists. Yeah. Yeah.
The journalists do, and we think we do, right?
We want to emphasize
that we try.
Yeah, yeah. I think when making that point to people that, you know, everyone is biased and we can only try to mitigate bias, I think some people mistakenly perceive that as saying, like, truth is relative, that there is no truth. And mm-hmm. I've seen that confusion before. Mm-hmm. And I have to, you know, I try to emphasize, like, no, it's not saying truth doesn't exist. It's just saying it's very hard for us to know that we have the truth as individual humans. You know, there's always,
yes,
these layers, and it's very hard to define the truth or know what the truth is. The truth may exist for X, Y, Z, but whether we mm-hmm. know the truth, you know, and then there's also even just the element of, like, different values can result in different truths, right?
Yes.
How you know, like the trolley problem, right? There's no, like, answer to the trolley problem, because it depends on mm-hmm. different biases or values you bring to the table to try to answer these, like, questions about morality or what the best outcomes are. So just to say, yeah, the landscape can be very confusing, and we all have our biases that we bring to the table. But all we can do is try to, yeah, reach something that resembles removing ourselves from it. Yeah.
What I say that we aim for is an objective as possible evaluation. I always say as possible, because when we get comments on a particular news source, it's always funny to me when people accuse us of being biased. Like, especially if you see our Facebook comments, they'll say, well, I, as a longtime listener of NPR, I can assure you that they're much further left than that. And then somebody else right underneath that says, well, as a longtime listener of NPR, I assure you they're a lot further right than that. And just looking at that, like, who has the truth there? Mm-hmm. If they talk to each other, like, they're obviously seeing this very same thing quite differently. So having a little bit of self-awareness that everyone who's accusing us of being biased is also biased. Like, let's recognize that too. We refrain from saying, well, so are you. We just admit that we are. And I tell folks that no one agrees with every individual rating on our chart, including myself. Because it's impossible. Because like my sample of all the things that I've read and listened to and watched is much smaller than the sample than the composite view of our analysts. Like, well, nearly 100 people have participated in our ratings as analysts over the years. 100 people who are trained, having read 70,000 articles together, came up with this composite view of the truth, objective as possible truth. So from any one person's vantage point, it's going to be off from their own.
It's kind of like the wisdom of the group kind of thing. You combine the group's take as a whole can be better than any one person's.
Yeah. And I like to distinguish that though from just opinion polling, because opinion polling can be not very granular. And that's been the very common way of measuring media bias and trust. Like, do you trust Fox News or do you trust MSNBC? And that typically just tells you, like, you get like a 50-50 answer because your audience.
Speaking of the difficulty of removing bias, you know, I'm somebody who's for years now has been working on removing bias from my language because I wrote a book aimed at conservatives and liberals. And I was trying to, you know, that just naturally progressed where I was like, I need to really speak in persuasive ways. And so I've been thinking about this for a while. And then I noticed something fairly recently where I noticed I was more likely to use the word expert for people that I agreed with when I described them, you know, and if I didn't agree with them, I might choose another word like a professional or something else. But that was just a case where I was like, oh, I didn't realize that I was doing that, but now it's completely obvious. But that's just getting at, even when we try, like, there can be various ways that our biases creep in.
I notice the same thing because I speak to audiences that are left, right, and center all the time. So I'm very cognizant of how my words will land. Because if I am perceived as biased, I lose credibility.
Yeah, it's part of the process is trying to speak in ways that do not seem biased to show that you're trying, yeah, to remove the bias. So you've talked in your process about your process involving someone from the left, the right, and the center. And one thing that strikes me there is it can be hard to define those labels, especially as the landscape becomes more and more kind of turbulent and chaotic as polarization becomes worse. You know, for example, what is viewed as conservative views could be seen to shift abruptly under Trump, you know, as he kind of changed things about more protectionism and more policies that previously had been seen as more liberal and these kinds of things. And I'm wondering how you arrive on who is, you know, who represents the conservative view and who represents the middle and who represents the liberal view.
That's something that we've thought a lot about, because when people first look at the chart and when I was first putting it together, you know, left and right, like in the United States, we just have these broad concepts. I actually had the words liberal and conservative on the first version of the chart and realized that you know, left and right are broader because, you know, liberal and conservative don't quite capture the whole range. You know, we have so many subdivisions of what people call themselves and what people call each other on the left as categories, like progressives versus moderates, center rights, in there's like more pejorative terms like MAGA or socialists or communists or fascists or whatever. But there are like reasonable gradations. So left and right is meant to capture the broadest. But the more you look at it, like the more politically savvy you are, the more you realize that these things do shift over time. So many folks look at the chart and they say, oh, well, that's just the Overton window. You know, this concept that what's acceptable in political discourse, at the, especially the fringes, changes over time. People talk about, you know, folks moving the goalposts. And that certainly does happen. So what we're trying to capture is how media publications present things in relation to what the current U.S. left-right spectrum is at the time. Mm. So it's U.S., so you know, country-based, it's contemporary, it's now, but we anchor it on is the policy positions and actions of elected officials. Because how do you measure what's left and right in the United States right now? Like what people think, what the citizens think? That's something you can measure like with polling, but there's a lot of different issues. There's a lot of squishiness there. Mm-hmm. We couldn't anchor it on what the media is calling as left and right because we're trying to measure the media. But a thing that you can consistently point to is the policy positions and actions and statements of political elected officials. Like they have power to legislate and influence, and they say things on cable television and on social media and on their platforms and their websites. So you can gauge like what a particular elected official is saying, and you can kind of put them on a spectrum. You know, you and I could identify who are the furthest right and furthest left elected members of Congress, who are moderate members of Congress or governors or what have you. And we have an idea of like who those people are, and those anchor spots on the chart. So however the media is talking about political positions and relative to those is how we anchor it. And issue by issue, it varies. Like some issues are stay similar over time, like abortion. You know, what's left and what constitutes left and right about that stays similar over time. But on things like immigration, I'd say moves a little bit quicker. When you have a fast moving situations, for example, what's a centrist right, a moderate right, and a far right position on whether Trump should have been impeached for January 6th, right? That's something that wasn't a question before, but you could figure out what the moderate versus strong versus extreme positions were on that just by looking at the elected officials.
Yeah, or COVID, for example, like it's possible to imagine
yes.
COVID, you know, going a different way if Trump had initially taken really hard stances against COVID and such, like sort of like Republicans did with Ebola a few years before. Like they were the ones more hardcore about fighting Ebola a few years before that and these kinds of things. Like I interviewed Michael Macy. I don't know if you know him, but he talks about he's researched opinion cascades and how there's a chaotic element to some of the things that are new emerging sources of polarization and how they could theoretically go different ways depending on who the early trendsetters are.
Yes.
So I think that's a really important point to, you know, getting to the difficulty of defining, of using labels like conservative and Republican or conservative and liberal to describe some of the stance formations, basically.
And we polarize everything. It's funny you mentioned the COVID. I'm sure you've read Ezra Klein's Why We're Polarized. Mm-hmm. That was pre-COVID. I think an example of things he said that we tend to not polarize was, you know, epidemics because they're so science-based. And it was right when COVID was starting. I was like, oh no. And you could see how that was getting polarized in news coverage. And when it wasn't on our shores, it wasn't like when it was still just in China or just in Italy, before it had really gotten to the United States, the news coverage wasn't polarized about it. Mm-hmm. But as soon as it was like, it's going to come here, we decided to take polarized positions about like, is it going to come here? Yes or no, based on my guy. And how bad is it going to be? What should we do about it? Every single question, because that's what we do. I think, better than anyone else right now in the world.
Well, yeah, Americans are always leading the world. You know, now we're leading. We're leaders at polarization. I
mean, we can polarize literally anything.
You know, I do sometimes think that it seems relatively unexamined, but the idea that America is basically, because in the same way that we've spread media and entertainment and our culture to the rest of the world, like we are spreading our polarization to the rest of the world. I think there's something there. But anyway, that's a topic for another time. Yeah. And to your point, I think of it much in the same way, because I've seen this, the idea that the conservative and liberal labels aren't very good. And it's much more about the Republican Democrat kind of tribe. Right. And so whatever those political groups do kind of creates the stances associated with those tribes. And I almost went back to in my book, because in my book I use liberal and conservative a lot. And I am thinking about going back and changing it more to like Republican and Democrat, just to emphasize that point, you know. And I had some caveats at the beginning of how rough the language was anyway, but that seems like a better, you know, or left and right, which is kind of what you were getting at. Like I think that's the same concept you were getting at. It's just a rough approximation of this Republican/Democrat divide.
Yes. Well, when we look at it in other countries, you know, we can still use left and right, because, you know, we've done some work with NGOs in other countries that want to replicate the media bias chart in their countries. And so, you know, we can, in English-speaking Western democracies, the left-right spectrum maps fairly closely. You know, there's obviously intricacies in the local politics, but so many of these other countries don't have this fixed two-party system that our Constitution has entrenched in the United States. So it's especially strong here. But when you have parliamentary systems where there's multiple parties that are along a spectrum, you can still see media follow like left and right. So there are some things about left and rightness that are somewhat universal, just like fascism, communism. You know, folks associate one communism with the left and fascism with the right, even though they're both types of authoritarianism. Authoritarianism and populism, you can see lots of populism on the far left and the far right. There's so many different factors that universally being able to most issues you can map on a left to right spectrum, which is why we use it.
Yeah, totally. As a grouping of stances, it can make a lot of sense, because a lot of things do slot in there. Yeah, I think it becomes more confusing for like the individual stances, you know, it's when you get into like, oh, this is a liberal stance or this is a conservative stance, because some of those things can vary like across the world. Like there's countries where, as I understand it, the more conservative stances in a lot of countries is more pro-choice, because they're more for individual liberty. So that can actually vary. But so there's like these variations like that. So it's tougher for the individual stances, basically. Yeah. A quick note here. One book that examines some ambiguity in terms like liberal and conservative is the book The Myth of Left and Right, written by Verlin and Hiram Lewis. If you're curious what people are talking about when they talk about the ambiguity in these terms, that might be a book you'd enjoy. Back to the talk.
Getting back to your question about how we determine who's like left, right, and center, we do a bunch of different evaluations. They're all self-evaluations, but one of the principal ones we do is have people go on a list about 20 issues, and issue by issue, like how strongly left or right are you on, you know, LGBT civil rights, K-12 education, taxes, foreign policy, which is itself a big one, you know, gun rights or, you know, gun control. The reason we do that is because most articles are about one or two political issues at a time. Usually one article isn't about like everything that you can be conservative or liberal about. You know, it's like one, two, maybe three issues. Like it's about immigration, and maybe it'll touch on, you know, national security and budget issues. But it's not usually also going to talk about gun rights and abortion in the same article.
So let's see. 1 second. Looking at my notes here.
I did very much like your article about polarization is not the problem, the critique of that argument. And you had some interesting thoughts on the term use of the term misinformation.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you about that for sure. What are your thoughts on that word? Because I think other people have written about this, but the liberal, you know, the perceptions that it's very liberal leaning word.
I purposely avoid using the term misinformation when we talk about our work and disinformation. So there are academic circles in which those terms have been formally defined, and it has to do with intent, the difference between mis and disinformation. And there's other definitions like malinformation. There's a taxonomy. There's like a glossary that some academics will use, but that is not how it's used by the general public. And when you can't really force your definitions of something onto other people, like people are going to use terms how they use the terms. And now people use a term really loosely and flippantly. They'll use it for information that they disagree with, for information that they just think is biased. It's just not a precise use in most cases. And if you accuse somebody of misinformation and then that thing turns out to be true, then like the word loses power. So folks often talk about how we need a common terminology, a common lexicon of how we talk about these issues of information quality. And I sort of disagree. I think our language should evolve because talking points, like words that people come up with to define an issue, they tend to lose power over time, especially as they get co-opted by another side. Mm. So when a word gets co-opted, when a word loses its power, when the definition of the word is so broad in usage, I try to stop using that word and just say the idea in more precise language.
Yeah, like something's wrong. A piece of information is wrong or distorted or whatever. That's easier to understand than...
Yeah, something specific. Like, right. This sentence is misleading because, or right. This fact is inaccurate because. So on our chart, even at the bottom, it doesn't say misinformation or disinformation. It says contains misleading information or contains inaccurate or fabricated information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I avoid that word for that reason too. There's just too much misuse of it, and I think it's very important to speak in ways that speak to a broad range of people. And if our goal is to persuade people of our ideas, it's up to us to use persuasive language. We can't just say like, oh, well, it's their fault for not understanding what we're saying, right? Like, I think that's a lot of people's default or is kind of this like, well, if they don't get it, that's on them. But to me, it's very important, if we care about, for example, if I care about polarization and trying to depolarize and reduce contempt, like it's up to me to make the case for that in persuasive terms, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, persuasion is the primary reason I got into this work. I was upset that people would use very biased content from their side to try to persuade people on the other side.
Exercise and futility there, yeah.
Exercise and futility. Like if somebody on the right tries to convince somebody on the left, like this is correct because look at this article from Breitbart that the person on the left just totally discounts it. And the person on the right is like, what? This is a perfectly valid, compelling explanation to me. And then the person on the left will do the same thing with, Alternet or HuffPost or something like that,
Right. And it's speaking different languages. Yeah.
Yes. And it sounds like, you have experienced this a lot. If it's just not persuasive, I'm not interested in that line of in that talk track. And around the issue of the word misinformation, sometimes people use it to refer to content, news content that's in a gray area. Mm-hmm. So there's opinion, there's a section on our chart, and then there's a misleading, but there's a section in the middle that's where we score things in the score range of 16 to 24. Our blanket term for that is a problematic area, but there's all sorts of things that are worse than opinion, but they're not misleading. Mm-hmm. They're vilification and dehumanization, or there's a mismatch between the headline and the article, or there's some material facts that are not corroborated, or there's extreme speculation. Like all of those things, we view them as, hey, that's not ideal in this news content. there's a bit of a problem with this so-called reporting. It's not just something you can chalk up to opinion. But if you call that stuff misinformation, it's not compelling. It's not convincing to folks who find it compelling.
And you're driving people away and making them more likely to view you as misinformation because they view you as taking a biased stance on a too aggressive stance on that. Yeah,
exactly.
I want to throw a note in here because I think this is important. Some people speak as if political passion is at odds with the work of reducing us versus them political animosity. There could be an instinct people have that goes something like, by telling us to reduce our us versus them anger and contempt, you're preventing us from working effectively towards our political goals. You're attempting to neuter us and take away our power. This is a common objection to depolarization in work, and it's such a huge misunderstanding of the work. I would say that in a bit of a counterintuitive way, the work of effective political activism is completely aligned with depolarization-aimed work. By attempting to actually persuade people on the other side, to really try to form persuasive, non-insulting arguments to convince the other side, you're by definition taking a depolarizing, de-escalating approach. The act of trying to persuade people who don't agree with you requires really trying to understand those people's beliefs and values and what their motivations are. It requires removing the biases you have about what they believe. It requires a lot of self-examination and a lot of thinking about how to best make connections. And doing that work naturally aligns with reducing us versus them contempt, because you'll usually find, once you try to understand the, quote, other side, you'll find the people in that group are not as alien or reprehensible as you previously imagined. You may still strongly disagree with them. You may still find the things they support dangerous and believe they're doing a lot of harm. But you'll have a better view of their humanity, and you will have lowered your contempt. This is what I mean when I say the work of political activism is completely aligned with depolarization endeavors. Okay, back to the talk. I want to ask you about speaking of the dehumanization. I actually was just looking at your LinkedIn post you'd put up about dehumanizing language. Could you talk a little bit about how the more ad hominem and contemptuous language factors in to your attempt to analyze bias?
Yes, it definitely is one of the main reasons that we'll score something lower than our opinion section. We have this binary framing of like news versus opinion, but there are opinions that are better supported, and then there are opinions that use things like ad hominem arguments. But what we find so problematic is dehumanization and vilification. And what we mean specifically by dehumanization is using words like somebody's indicating that somebody's not a human. You know, they're subhuman, they're an animal, they're a monster, they're a creature. And to me, that makes it harder to break out of cycles of violence. And the reason you see this so much, especially in the current like Israeli and Hamas conflict, you know, folks are calling folks on the other side not humans. And when you do that, it creates this like layer of abstraction. It creates this like mental barrier to seeing other people's humanity. And anytime you have a barrier to seeing people's humanity, it just makes it easier to convince people to like be indifferent to their suffering or be violent towards them. Mm-hmm. And people don't often mean it that way. Like sometimes people say they're monsters, they're animals, because they want to express extreme condemnation. Like they're so disgusted with a thing that they did. People do truly disgusting things. We reach for these words that try to express how outraged we are. Mm-hmm. But it has this side effect of making other people okay with justifying whatever retaliation or whatever violence in return. I encourage people to avoid doing that. And we score content lower for doing that just because it's definitely not convincing to the other side. And it makes it's worse than opinions that are supported by actual facts. So
yeah, and I see that. I talk about that a good amount in my book, of trying to get people to see basically their own role in these things, right? Like in the American divide, right? Like where people, you know, millions of people are issuing insults to the other group on social media, and that, you know, all this condescension and insults and threats and all these things play a role in our divides. Like we can be very much apart without realizing it, of creating the atmosphere that drives our divides, because all that animosity and contempt and dehumanization bubbles up. You know, that's what creates the support for more dehumanizing approaches to, you know, from leaders and in media and such. And so I was trying to make the case that, like, you know, it starts with us in a way that we have to see the power that we have. And often that's all that we can really change, right? Like, how much can we really change, but we do have control over how we act and how we speak on social media and see how those things contribute to the environment around us and how that all bubbles up. Anyway, yeah, I think that's it's important to see. I think.
Well, social media dehumanizes us a bit because we don't see the humanity of the person, like, behind the keyboard, right? Like, there's this layer in between us and them, and we will say things to them on social media that we wouldn't say in person. One of the real gifts of the work that we do that I get to experience is, you know, we have these unusual environments where every day somebody left, right, and center is like, they're all talking to each other about politics and coming to agreements, and they're face to face on Zoom, right? Mm-hmm. That's rare. And it's really a privilege to see people, like, working through this and working through disagreements in good faith, like assuming the good faith of the other side, like really listening, having people show you their perspective and having it convince you. I mean, this happens all the time. It's not perfect. You may, if people do have real disagreements, I tell my analysts, you know, the least we can do, like, if we want to have peace in the world, I've heard that says, you know, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. You know, the least we can do is, like, give our other analysts some grace and, like, and that peace, try to create it between us. Because if we ever expect it to be out in the world, you know, we have to model it, we have to do it, we have to practice it.
Are you investigating or have you seen any algorithmic approaches that are good for determining bias? You know, for example, one thing I've thought about was when I was reading some academic papers that I thought were pretty bad, and they were using language like never and always. And I was like, well, maybe you could create an algorithm that scans for all these different words that don't really have objective, you know, that aren't very objective. And then you could also, you know, throw in, like, words that are associated with bias and see how frequently they occur. Are those things you've explored?
Yeah, actually, we've done quite a bit of work in that space and around using, you know, machine learning and modeling to score articles. And we've actually just recently released a model that works quite well for scoring articles at scale. We've been doing this work for quite a long time. So for the last 4 years, we've scored over 70,000 articles by hand with, like, three people each. So it's, you know, 200,000 pieces of, like, human labeled data for reliability and bias with a score attached. And we, you know, capture the content. And so we've taken traditional machine learning approaches, plus added our own, like, features of things that we've noticed that characterizes these types of content. So we actually, our machine scoring model scores our articles on average within the standard deviation that our analysts do.
Wow.
So this is a new capability for us. You know, we're really excited about it. For us, it's so important to blend human ratings with AI because, you know, humans obviously aren't scalable enough for the millions of pieces of content out there, but AI is not accurate enough by itself. Mm-hmm. And these things change, right? Like, and the machine is still a machine, right? If you're looking at in breaking news articles from, you know, the last couple of days, you know, we want to make sure that we're doing the lateral reading and whatnot that goes into determining the reliability on these very, very important stories and keeping tabs, like continually training our model because the words that are biased, like what constitutes biased words, changes over time. CRT wasn't, critical race theory wasn't a word indicating bias in articles 18 months ago. Hard to believe. So
things can change quickly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which is shows the importance of the human element. Yeah. I wanted to get your take on something that I think is pretty bad. Matt Taibbi talked about it in his book, Hate Incorporated, where he talked about the reaction that many journalists and news outlets had when Trump was elected. Mm-hmm. They took it as a sign that they basically interpreted it as, oh, we weren't doing our jobs well enough. We were being too soft. Mm-hmm. And so they saw it as important to call out Trump and be more aggressive on these kinds of things. And that resulted in just a lot of bad journalism. For example, around the Trump-Russia stuff, there was a whole host of articles that could, you know, that were just clearly bad and irresponsible and rushed. And I was watching, you know, another example, I was watching MSNBC the other day, and which I seldom watch cable news.
Same.
But a show's anchor was slinging insults at Trump, calling him the disgraced former president, and these kinds of things. And there just seems like a giving up at even attempting, even for the more opinion approaches, you would think that people would attempt more persuasive language that would be more likely to speak to people on the other side. But it seems like the reaction of a lot of journalists were that, no, we have to get really tough and say, you know, make our stances more well-known, basically, and more obvious, which I think to me was, you know, a pretty bad misstep, because I think they didn't really see that so many conservatives already thought that there was an extreme liberal bias in the mm-hmm. media, which sometimes was more subtle and not as obvious to people, but it manifested as condescension about conservative points of view and often just an ignoring of the more rational aspects of conservative side views. So to me, this reaction by journalists was really a big part of the problem in exacerbating the polarization problem, which ties back into my thoughts on polarization, that, you know, we're often, our instincts on how to fix the problem that we perceive are often just driving us deeper into the problem.
Yes.
So I'm curious what your take on all of that is.
I totally agree. And I don't know if you recall during the run up to the 2016 election, the HuffPost made the editorial decision that at the end of every article on Donald Trump, they put an editor's note like, Donald Trump is a racist, xenophobic, blah, 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 who, you know, cheats on his taxes and whatever. Like, it was a note.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. They're like, this is an editorial decision we're making to you do this hard calling out of Donald Trump, like this pushing back, this fighting back. And you hear that a lot in really polarized camps, is that, you know, you just, the problem is you got to call the other side out. But in how many cases does calling the other side out, like specifically calling people wrong to their face as the beginning of your argument, mm-hmm. like how often does that result in them being like, oh yeah, you're totally right. I am stupid and wrong. And you have shown me the error of your ways. Like, that's just not how persuasion works. And people doubling down, it feels good. It feeds a confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And you can see, like, within like cable news shows and, you know, very left-leaning, very right-leaning publications, people just sort of, they buy their own BS. They're talking to each other. They're saying the same talking points. They're just like, they're in violent agreement with each other. And somebody looking, the folks that they would want to convince in order to advance a policy, which are people they disagree with, not even watching. Like, there's no way they would watch. Mm-hmm. Like, if they did, they just dismiss it completely. So I think it was a big mistake, especially when you've got outlets that do have wider audiences, like folks from the left and right read them, well-known publications with large readership bases, you know, CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, you know, to the extent that sections of their content in each of those outlets, they've got opinion sections, or for CNN, like the TV and evening divisions that really double down on this pushback kind of content, this opinion stuff. And that just erodes trust with anybody that they're trying to convince. Mm-hmm. The presence of opinion generally in reputable publications erodes trust. The format of it, the primary reason local news is so trusted is because it doesn't have an opinion section. Right. Like the evening show is like 13 stories, took them all day to gather it, and they deliver to you in half an hour. Some of them are about sports and weather. Like, they don't have time to like have four pundits on telling you what they think about the horse race stuff in Washington.
Regarding the opinion versus the straight news, it's like, I think a lot of people just don't really make the distinction between those. So I've heard people complain about Fox News shows, and they're like, that news is just completely false. And I'm like, well, a lot of that stuff is just their opinions, which is, you know, as much as we can disagree with it, it's like, they aren't even attempting, like, you mm-hmm. know, on they do a better job on the shows that are trying an actual, you know, it still might be biased, but they're doing a better job at reporting, you know, actual news when they're attempting to do it. But just the perception on both sides, I think across the board, is that most people just turn on these stations and they just see these opinions being lobbed and they're like, that's their version of the news, right? Mm-hmm. When it's not, it's just the fact that there's so many opinion shows.
We tend to see the other side's news through a very small aperture, a very small filter. We usually just see an example of the other side's news that's really terrible filtered through somebody that's on our side that we like. Mm-hmm. And we're like, I know exactly what people are watching over on Fox or over on MSNBC. But if you actually watch all the content every day, you go on our interactive media bias chart and just look up Fox shows. We have dozens of Fox shows, and some of them are like top middle, and some of them are, you know, bottom right on the chart, and a bunch of them are, you know, in between that. So there's this huge variation, and people don't make those distinctions. So if somebody on the left says, "I can't believe people watch Fox News," people who watch Fox News and are familiar with its better reputable versions, content. Yeah. And they're like, what are you talking about? Same thing with MSNBC, right? It's the same thing. So,
right. We focus on the most, yeah, there's all these systemic and emotional reasons why we focus on the most extreme or weird stuff on the other side. Yeah.
Of course.
Do you see part of your work or part of your motivations as helping with the polarization issue?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's like our reason for being. I mean, the reason we exist is to bring people together. The reason I started this company is because, you know, if we are this divided on, you know, the facts that we share and we can't talk to each other about politics, we can't solve our major problems. Like how can we hope to address some things that are as difficult as immigration, where there aren't really a lot of good answers when we're just so far apart on just what the facts are on the ground? I mean, the fact that people would lose friends and family members over discussions about politics is just really, that was disturbing to me. The fact that people can't talk about politics in their workplaces, you know, these all damage interpersonal relationships and our ability to function as families, as companies, and as a country. So I think that's fundamental to what we do, is to reduce polarization.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention about what you're working on before we sign off?
You know, people often are aware that we put out this media bias chart because they, you know, see the infographics that circulate frequently on social media. But I really encourage folks to come to our website and explore and see what we do for the various stakeholders in the media ecosystem, because how we're trying to affect society and positively transform it, you know, and reduce polarization is bringing in all the stakeholders to the media ecosystem. And the stakeholders are individual citizens, they're educators that are teaching media literacy, they're the brands that fund journalism, they're the publishers themselves, the social media companies that distribute them. Everyone has a role to play. And so we've designed our company. You know, what we do is we rate the news. We do all these ratings, but we provide tools for each of those kind of stakeholders, like media literacy education for high school and college, and you know, data sets and APIs for researchers and your commercial enterprises. So I just encourage people to learn more about what we do.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Vanessa. Thanks for joining me and thanks for your work.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was a talk with Vanessa Otero, founder of AdFontis Media, which you can learn more about at AdFontisMedia.com. If you want to learn more about political polarization and why it's such a big problem and what we can all do about it, consider signing up for my Depolarization Aimed Substack or getting my book, Diffusing American Anger. You can learn more about that work at my site, American-Anger.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.